This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Happy Tuesday afternoon. This hour, between now and the news at 1 o'clock, a bleak outlook for future wheat prices with a potential record crop coming out of the Black Sea. You're also going to meet the latest inductee into the Agricultural Hall of Fame. Can you guess who that might be? This is selected by the Royal Agricultural Society of Western Australia. You will meet that person shortly after 12:30 here on the Country Hour. And we're in the home straight. Just four more sleeps until Australia votes in the federal election. What are the key concerns for you, your family, and your business as you decide how you're going to vote this time round? 0448 922 604. Text through and tell me what is going through your mind. What really matters to rural Western Australians in this federal election? The text 0448 922 604. To kick off the conversation, I've pulled together a few people from rural WA for a special election panel discussion that's going to take us through to the news headlines at 12:30. So let me introduce you to Jackie Jarvis, the CEO of the Rural Regional Remote Women's Network of WA and owner of Jarvis Estate Wines in Margaret River. She was also the 2014 WA Rural Woman of the Year and former Senior Policy Advisor to Agriculture Minister Alana McTiernan. Neil Wandle is here. He's the owner of Esperance Quality Grains and former chairman of the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group. And Peter Boyle, a York-based cropping and sheep farmer, mainly focused on selling sheep to the live export market. Jackie Jarvis, we'll kick off with you. How are you reading the situation as we count down to the vote on Saturday?
Well, look, I think, you know, if we're looking at it from a regional, rural perspective, I don't think WA's actually cracked much of a mention. Everything that I sort of see in the mainstream media and on social media seems very focused on East Coast issues. And I do wonder if rural and regional WA are kind of sort of scratching their heads a bit going, does anyone care? Does anyone care what we think?
Do you think it's different than other federal elections, Jackie? I mean, even more so this time round that it's focused on the eastern states rather than what's happening here in the west?
Well, I think what happens for the general public who aren't involved in farming is they hear issues about, you know, Murray-Darling water, and they hear issues about, you know, drought on the east coast. And I think a lot of city voters perhaps just sort of switch off and go, well, that's all the rural issues we need to worry about. Whereas I think in WA, we obviously have a very unique set of circumstances, and it would be nice for the mainstream media to actually pay a bit more attention.
Neil Wandle, how are you reading it with less than a week to go?
You know, the polls are sort of leading to a change of government, but I sort of sense, you know, there might be a little bit of swing. It might be a bit closer than people are predicting, so it'll be certainly very interesting. But like all politics, it's probably 4 or 5% of people in the whole population who decide what goes in at government, and that's what all the policies are targeted at, I'm afraid.
Peter Boyle.
Very nervous. A change of government could severely affect my business, especially the live shipping. We have not had a definition from Fitzgibbon about the northern summer yet, whether it's 1st of May to the end of October or it's 1st of June to the end of August. If it is the first one, then the trade is over. So the load I'm doing today, that I'm getting out today, could be my last load of sheep for live shipping.
This is one of the really clear distinctions between the two major parties, that is, this issue of the future of live exports, and we're talking particularly about sheep, and the Labor Party. Joel Fitzgibbon's been quite clear on phasing out the trade within a five-year period. On the other side, the Coalition saying they're supportive of the sheep trade with that 3 month sort of closure of the trade during the peak heat season into the Northern Hemisphere summer, but still supportive of the trade going forward. What would a Labor government mean to your business, particularly with that phase out of the live trade for sheep over 5 years, Peter?
We would have time to adjust, possibly, and hopefully argue for a better outcome than the total phase out over 5 years with the current level of losses on the boats. They're exceptionally low. But if they bring in the long northern summer, then I don't think that the shippers will exist in WA because they can't afford to keep staff for 6 months not doing anything and their ships idle in Australia for 6 months. So I'd say that if it's a six-month northern summer break, it's over.
And Belinda, it's Jackie here. I might just sort of say that perhaps that ambiguity about the dates might leave a little bit of leeway for WA producers to get in there and really lobby for what dates they think are appropriate. So you can only hope that the ambiguity, you know, works in the favour of WA sheep producers.
Peter, are you voting on that issue alone in this federal election?
No, I'm also voting on the strict visa conditions we have for having employees come to WA for seasonal work. We've had a terrible time trying to get staff, and the staff that we get, they say they can speak English, and they can, but they don't comprehend, and they need training. We think it's an essential that you can have, once you get your staff trained up, because they want to come back each season, and they're not allowed to. So we think that's a must for the visa thing, so we can have reliable, consistent staff. We advertised all over Australia, got one applicant Australian to work for us. We've got an Argentinian, Kiwi, Englishman and an Israeli at the moment. So it's international rules at our place.
Neil, is it a similar situation for you and the business you run in Esperance, that search every season to try and get those seasonal workers?
It probably doesn't affect my business, but for my sons, who both probably in the middle of seeding have got six or eight people each out there, and I think both of them have only got one Australian. The rest are all Kiwis, Germans, French, all over the world. And if we could get a second-year visa and those people come back for the second year, they, you know, no training involved, they step right into it, it'd be a marvellous outcome.
Neither party is committed to the agricultural visa. I think by the sounds of things, the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, is supportive of the agricultural visa, which the National Farmers Federation says is really important to get up and running. But he's got to convince the rest of the government, I guess, to pull them along with him on that issue. And the other side, Joel Fitzgibbon's still asking the question, what is an agricultural visa? Jackie Jarvis, how important is this ag visa? Is that going to be the solution to this?
Well, look, it's not just an ag visa. It's also about farming families being out of access to people who can do childcare and in-home support during seeding and harvest and those peak times. We have an issue at the moment where you can't give someone a sign-off on a second-year visa if they're looking after the kids. But if they're out driving a tractor, you can. And what that happens is it means a lot of women are locked out of being, you know, active participants in their farming business. This seems to come back again. You know, we have this focus on Sydney, and I'm sick of hearing about Western Sydney, quite frankly. You know, we have this fear of immigration because, you know, there's too much traffic in Western Sydney. We have this fear of people coming into Australia because of this fear. And so I think that's why everyone's sitting on the fence on this. I mean, it's pretty simple. Allocate visas to particular postcodes.
I think that'd be a great outcome. So certainly, hopefully, that both parties will seriously look at it.
Peter, are you hopeful that that is something that's going to be addressed, whoever forms government after next weekend's election?
Hopeful, but nervous. That probably sure that nothing will happen in the end. They'll all talk about it and there'll be no positive result for us. But the other point is Lee Webster's type set up that she's got in York for screening and pre-training a staff for farm work is that a brilliant thing to help with safety and everything else, and gives us a bit more time to actually do our farm work rather than spending every season training four or five guys, educating them. One guy could speak good English, but he didn't know what the word stop meant. So when you say stop, he runs over you. So that sort of thing is pretty scary.
Look, and look, I've had lots of good discussions with Lee as well, who, for those of you who don't know, you know, runs a business where she trains up backpackers to go onto farm. And she's also pushing this idea that sometimes we just need someone in to help in the house, to help with that childcare. You know, we have this idea in Australia that all childcare must be gold standard, diploma educated people who can offer this amazing level of childcare. Well, that's fantastic. But if your closest childcare centre is 60, 80 kilometres away and you only need seasonal help, it doesn't actually help the situation. You know, likewise, if you whether you're picking fruit or harvesting, you need people who can come in and do that work. And this also ties in with the question about the live sheep trade. You know, this idea that we're all going to do this onshore processing is fantastic. But I can tell you, those abattoirs in regional WA cannot get enough people to actually, you know, if there was a sudden uptake of onshore processing, we would actually struggle for people to do those jobs. There's not too many 15-year-olds sitting in school at the moment saying, I really want to go work in the abattoir.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But the thing that really concerns me, if we get a hung parliament and we don't get a decisive outcome either way, and we have the Greens sitting there with a balance of power, you know, I'm really worried about some of their legislation and some of their policies. And
can you give us an example of a policy that you're really concerned about if that situation eventuates?
Oh, some of their policy they've got in Queensland about trees and clearing and what you do, and I think they're trying to bring in that you've got to have shelter in every paddock for all your stock and plant trees here or put up physical shelters. And I think we need protection from farmers. It's the right to farm. You know, we've seen what's happened with the activist, and also I think we're getting to the stage, we're getting so tied down with red tape and bureaucracy in farming today that it's nearly getting too hard to farm. And it worries me if we get Greens in power, they, you know, they have a different outlook. Most of them are city-based. Most of them, the activist people sort of sit in that parliament, and really worries where we're going to go as an industry going forward, because at the end of the day, the farmers are still the best custodians of their land. I truly believe that. And there's no farmer out there who dearly likes to destroy their land or the country. But if we get control by too much red tape, it'll be a nightmare.
ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, and a bit of a round table this afternoon, just talking about some of the key issues in the lead up to the federal election this Saturday. And I guess some of the issues too that aren't quite there on the discussion table, but still really important to rural Australia, rural Western Australia. With you this afternoon, Neil Wandle. He's in the Esperance studio. He's from Esperance Quality Grains. Jackie Jarvis joining us from the Bunbury studio. She's CEO of the Triple R Network and also the owner of Jarvis Estate Wines in Margaret River. And Peter Boyle, sheep producer and grain grower from York. Neil, what would be some of the key issues that would be put forward, some sort of policy that would be put forward by one of the major parties or smaller parties, independents, that would really make you sit up and listen, that would make a difference to your business today?
I think there's a real big gap in Australia with the export, and so we're not speaking from one clear voice from Australia. You know, we have four or five different organisations in Australia all trying to pie for power or do that. And I think our peers around the rest of the world are getting more organised, especially on the for market development, and they're our competitors, the Argentinians, the Black Sea, America. And at the moment in Australia, we just have three or four organisations who don't seem to want to get together and work for the good of the whole industry. There's too many egos, I believe, sitting in some of these organisations on the East Coast especially. And we've got two completely different industries. We've got the East Coast grain industry and the Western Australian and South Australian grain industry, who are export-focused, and over the East is domestic-focused. And I think it's critical, and it'll have to be driven by government sooner or later, that they say you've got to stop what's going on and get together, form one decent national organisation that can speak for Australia in the world markets.
Don't we have the National Farmers Federation?
Yeah, we have them, but I've got to be real careful. But I'm not quite sure they're that effective. You know, we've got two other big grain producers in Australia, and we've got Grain Trade Australia. You know, I just think it's too disorganised. There's nothing, you know, there's really no who to speak to. I think we're going backwards on the export development side for this nation.
What are some of the key issues for you, Jackie? Something, the policy, an issue that would make a difference to the communities that you represent, or even your business, your wine business?
For both my business and also the women I represent in the Triple R Network, and also, you know, my background is workforce development and agriculture, and changes to the visa system would actually make me sit up and actually take notice. And I think for a lot of businesses, you know, we've heard about, you know, the issues with grain and livestock, but, you know, there's major horticultural businesses in the forest electorate here. We've got dairy farming businesses. You know, you just go up to the Gascoyne in Carnarvon, they're all facing the same issues. And this is about productivity. And the problem is visas and immigration all get thrown into one big bucket with overcrowding in cities, in East Coast cities. And it's really fallen off the radar, this election. I don't think, you know, other than a few mentions of an ag visa, that certainly doesn't seem to be on anyone's radar.
How frustrating is that when you've got really solid ideas about what could really make a difference in some of these communities, and it just doesn't seem to be getting the airtime or the attention of the politicians to take it forward.
The major issue we have in WA is we have such massive electorates, and so, you know, it's really hard for anyone, an independent, a nationals, anyone to even be in the running, because if you imagine if you're trying to, you know, service a seat like Durack or O'Connor, you almost feel like that, you know, all sides of politics turn up WA at the start of the election and then we don't see them again. I'm not sure, you know, you can sort of spread this message and said, well, if we made these seats a bit more marginal, you might get a bit more attention. But that's, you know, that doesn't reflect at the polling booth.
Yeah, I agree with that. We, you know, the population in rural, especially in farming, is dropping down and down. And, you know, it's still Australia and a democracy, one vote, one value. But I think we need to get the people into the cities to realise that farming is still a very important part of the economy. We need support and we need to have our voice heard.
Peter, is there anything that would make you sit up and take note, a policy that would be put forward that would make a really big difference to your business today?
A sudden burst of money to fix up some of our roads, for a start, and distance education. When you send your kids off to school, like in York, even the school, people want to send their kids to Northern High School. They can't even get them on the bus to Northern High School because the bus is full. So if they want to send them to Perth or anything, they've got to cop the lot. So whether there's a tax deduction or something like that for the extra costs, that would make a lot of country people sit up and take notice. It's a very expensive business to educate kids.
And it's interesting, you know, to talk about tax deductibility, because that's another barrier I want to push, is tax deductibility for childcare. Because, again, you know, you can have someone come and live on your farm and offer you childcare, and it's all at your own expense because, you know, it's not this approved long daycare centre that might be 50, 60 kilometres away. So the burden of rural families, and it's men and women raising children, no matter what age, you know, it's a huge burden. And don't even get me started on what it costs once you send them to university. And you know, there's a policy that deems that your income's too high for them to get any support. So you end up actually running two households.
Education is a big thing, certainly from aspirants here. But we've got a pretty good high school here, but the cost of sending your grandkids to Perth is not cheap today and getting dearer. So we thought it was expensive when we were paying $14,000 a year, and now I think they're $50,000 a year to send your children away. And if you're like one of my sons has got no access to high school, you've got no option. They have to go to Perth.
We'll have four kids at high school at once. So you can see what the cost is.
Wait till they get to university.
That's without university. That's just the 5 years or 6 years of high school at $200,000 a year. It's good fun.
And I can, you know, I'll keep harping on about the university, but it is incredibly frustrating when we're helping to support, you know, our daughter in Perth because our family income's deemed too high, and yet, you know, she'll be at university with people in Perth who are living in the family home in the suburbs who are accessing, you know, financial support. It's incredibly frustrating, and it is a burden, and you obviously want your kids to go on and achieve great things, but I would imagine there'd be some families where the burden would be too great. Thankfully, I've only got three children, not four. I worked out what caused it.
Well, I'm going to have about eight grandkids at Perth all at the same time in a couple of years' time, and I keep telling them, make sure you don't stuff it up and get expelled in year 12 or I'll cut you out of the will.
ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, an election roundtable this afternoon. We've got Neil Wandle from Esperance Quality Grains, Jackie Jarvis, CEO of the Triple R Network and owner of Jarvis Estate Wines, and Peter Boyle, sheep producer and grain grower from York, joining us on the panel this afternoon. I want to go around the table and ask the question, which party is really speaking for the rural sector today? Which one? Which person, an independent, a smaller party, the major parties, which one is speaking for the rural sector today? Neil Wandle.
Yeah, I think probably the National Party is probably at the national level is trying to make a voice, but, you know, realistically, they're not going to win that many seats, and whether they're going to really be an outcome in this election or not, it's really going to be hard to say. I think they'll probably struggle to win the lower house seat here. They might get some people in the Senate in Western Australia. But I think their policies are probably the soundest at the moment, the ones that I see. I think they represent the farming community best of any of them. Whether they're going to be effective and get enough seats to make a difference is going to be different.
Yes, I would say the same thing, the Nationals. They're eastern states, mate, and it's very difficult for us to communicate with them. Trying to talk to Minister Littleproud over this live shipping thing has been an absolute disaster. So they need to remember that we're also their constituents over the whole of Australia, and it would be much better if they would allow access to come and just talk to us one-on-one or in a group or something, just to get our feeling on lots of issues instead of just shutting the gate on us.
You know, one of the issues is in WA is those voters who you know, might put number one for their local Nationals candidate, if they put two for the Liberal candidate, they're essentially cancelling out their vote. And then it's very hard for the WA Nationals to get that foothold. I mean, I think if we think back to when Brendan Grylls, you know, introduced royalties for regions and actually came out very publicly and said, the coalition's off and I will negotiate with Lib and Labor, at the time it was considered quite shocking. But if we all remember, there was a few days there where people were a bit worried that the WA Nationals would actually do a deal with the Labor state government. I do wonder if the WA Nationals actually, you know, were a bit more vocal. I live in the Cedar Forest. I've seen two signs for Nationals candidates and it just says something about Big Nick. I have no idea who Big Nick is. I've seen more posters for Rob Cullerton, the former One Nation senator, than I have seen for the Nationals. So it is a bit of a shame that they're not getting that cut through. With regards to who represents rural Australia, you know, I wonder about the new independent at Indi taking over from Cathy McGowan. You've got people like Rob Oakeshott. I know that there's been a bit of a push from an independent in New England in Barnaby Joyce's seat. I guess you can only hope that if some of those rural-based independents get in, that they can perhaps represent the views of rural Australia.
Frustrated at our lack of power, that's all.
But is that the same as usual, or is it a different level of frustration this time round, Peter?
It's become more serious. The policies are affecting us to a deeper level now. We used to be able to get around it, but nowadays it seems to be really, the policies are starting to bite. That's what's really, if they bring in this Greens thing, if they bring in, shut the live shipping, all these have really serious ramifications. And another one for farm succession is superannuation. And here they are, they're fiddling with it and trying to cut it out. How on earth do we get their parents off the farm if they can't succeed with their super?
Yeah, that's a very good point, and that really worries me, and I think some of the Labor's policy on superannuation worries me. You know, there's a lot of money, trillions of dollars sitting in super now, and, you know, if they go down the track, and I think Mr. Shorten has made the comment that it's, you know, superannuation is not for your kids' inheritance. If we ever go back to a death tax or something like that, it'll be a disaster for farming community because, you know, most of us are asset-rich and cash-poor. And you know, it's really hard for your sons and family to actually buy the land off you, nowadays. You have to have some way of transitioning to the next generation. And that really worries me if they start fiddling with the superannuation side of things.
So just to wrap up, we'll go around the table again. Jackie, starting with you, less than a week to go. We're voting on Saturday. What are some of those thoughts in your mind, the key points as you lead up to that moment where you go into the ballot and cast your vote?
I mean, I think my main issue and concern is that the rural WA is not really counting, and it's because, you know, that thing about incumbency, that it's considered by all parties as a bit of a fait accompli that the Liberals will get in those regional seats, and it's almost a bit of despondency that you're going to the ballot box and sort of wondering if your vote, no matter who you're voting for, will actually make any difference.
Neil Wandle?
Yeah, I just hope that whoever gets in power actually has a heart for the rural community. We certainly need someone to come in there and make some changes. I think there's some issues that need to be looked at with GRDC and some of the funding. A lot of money goes in there, and there's a lot of debate at the moment whether some of it's getting wasted. And at the end of the day, it's going to have to be the government that are going to come in and have some firm policies and make some changes, I believe, because the industry is too divided at this stage. So I just hope that we get a clear majority either way in this government, and then it's the election, and then they can get on, because we have a split house, we're not going to get much change in the next 3 years at all. That's the way I see it.
Peter Boyle, what's going through your mind as you head towards this Saturday?
Oh, I reckon we live in a space where it might as well be the moon, really, when it comes to the federal politics. So I'm really concerned that we'll be totally neglected, and that's my concern. We're just too far away. We're totally different to the eastern states, and they don't care.
Yeah.
Well, on that very positive chipper note, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for being part of the discussion. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Belinda.
Thanks, Belinda.
Neil Wandall, the owner of Esperance Quality Grains. Jackie Jarvis, the CEO of the Rural Regional Remote Women's Network of WA, owner of Jarvis Estate Wines in Margaret River and former Senior Policy Advisor to Agriculture Minister Alana McTiernan, and Peter Boyle, cropping and sheep farmer from York.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Get to some of your texts in just a moment. First, though, Ellie Colvin is in the studio. What's making the headlines, Ellie?
Thanks, Belinda. The Police Minister, Michelle Roberts, says supervision protocols are being reviewed for people who are in custody but require hospital treatment. It comes after a 30-year-old man allegedly stabbed a nurse in the neck at Royal Perth Hospital on Sunday. He'd been arrested the previous day over an unrelated assault but needed medical attention and so was taken straight to the hospital. Parents and students at a southwest school have called for a deputy principal to be reinstated after he was stood down for allegedly assaulting a student. Eton Community College deputy principal Grant Walton was trying to break up a fight at the school in March when the alleged assault occurred. A Californian jury has ordered chemical giant Monsanto to pay more than $2 billion to a couple who contracted cancer after using its weed killer. It's the biggest payout against the company over the commonly used weed killer Roundup. Thanks, Belinda. More news at 1.
Ellie, thank you for that. 29-1. And picking up on that Monsanto case that Ellie was just talking to you about very shortly here on the Country Hour, Richard Hudson will come into the studio and just go through that particular case in a little more detail for you. Just before crossing to the Bureau of Meteorology, some of your texts coming through as we had that discussion, the election panel in the lead up to the federal election this Saturday. This from Mick: I don't think anyone has sympathy for people who spend $50,000 a year on education. ABC and the Country Hour proving yet again it has no clue. Thanks, Mick. Terry in Esperance says, really enjoyed the panel you had today. Whilst the thought of a Labor government scares me, I'll be voting them over Liberal Rick Wilson. And the screen has just jumped, Rick Wilson in O'Connor. As one panellist mentioned, we need to turn these rural seats marginal so we get noticed, because this campaign has shown we are forgotten and have been taken for granted at the expense of the big cities in the east. Thank you for that, Terry. This Labor, Liberal or Greens, no matter who wins this Saturday, none of them can make it rain. And if we don't get anything decent out of this cold front on Thursday, there won't be any WA agriculture to sell this year anyway. This too, as a farm worker, it would be good to see more workers helping in agriculture. Should be good experience and work for the young people. And decriminalisation and easier access of cannabis. Action to protect environments and new programs to educate young people in driving skills, work skills, life skills and apprenticeships. Be part of the conversation. The text 0448 922 604 if you want to be part of that chat between now and the news at 1 o'clock. Off to the Bureau now. Let's see what's ahead. See if there is any rain on its way. Noel Pusey with you this afternoon. Noel, a quick look at northern and eastern parts.
Pretty much clear for the next 4 days anyway. So easterly flow up there, fairly dry conditions right through. In fact, they're starting to get some showers and storms back, perhaps from into the east, East Kimberley during Sunday and maybe into Monday and Tuesday as well. But until then, clear conditions up there. And even in the east, not a great deal happening except for some stuff we'll talk about. Perhaps when you talk about the southern districts as well, since it mostly affects the Eucla region. So we've got a high pressure ridge south of the state that behind the bites moving to the east, and a front moving up towards the west coast, probably reaching the South Capes Wednesday night, probably close to midnight there before the shower activity starts. And then a period of showers extending through the South Land Division into the southwest goldfields during Thursday. The majority of the showers, I think, will have cleared the west coast during the morning, but there will be some shower activity through most areas and into the southern Gascoyne even late on Thursday, continuing through there on Friday. The rainfall amounts, look, it's not the world's strongest front. I don't think there's going to be season-breaking rainfall, but there will be sort of sort of 5 to 10 millimetres through western and southern parts, and lighter bits through the northeast parts of the Great Southern and the Central Wheat Belt through there, and similar sort of amounts reaching into the southwest goldfields as well. That front then moves to the east, and a low develops in the wake of the front towards the South Australian border, but offshore there. Some cold conditions continuing through sort of from Friday into Saturday, and there's a chance of some light hail, or small hail anyway, along the south coast, perhaps late on Thursday, but really through east of Esperance on Friday and through the Euclid during Saturday, as well as the low develops and moves slightly to the east. In the wake of that system, though, further on, we have what looks like another cold front approaching for Monday of next week as well, so some shower activity with that as well. So I think between this front on Thursday and perhaps the one on Monday, Tuesday, at this sort of range anyway, that there will be some reasonable rainfall, but it's not super heavy amounts, I don't think, even in total between the two of them.
All right. Just on Monday and Tuesday, what's it looking like? And I know it's early days, but can you give us a bit of an idea of how it's shaping up at this point in terms of how much rain might fall?
Oh, look, it is very early. I think there'll be another sort of similar sort of range to the previous one. So, again, falls lighter in the east, but 5 to 10 for the front Monday, perhaps into Tuesday as well. But, it's more wintry, the pattern, perhaps, than we've seen with a cycle of fronts moving through. So that's optimistic. But, yeah, just probably the usual reminder that most of WA's rainfall in the south at least falls between June and August. So they're the winter months, and there's a real peak in the rainfall there. So it isn't not that unusual to have a dryish start to, or dryish finish to autumn anyway. So I think we'll get some rainfall, but it will be perhaps confined more to the winter months than perhaps been the normal for the last couple of years anyway.
All right, well, let's hang on to that point at this stage. Warnings this afternoon, Noel?
Yeah, only no warnings current for today. There's just strong wind warnings for coastal waters in that sort of Cape Leeuwin to Windy Harbour region offshore from that for the approach of the front during Wednesday night. That's for tomorrow.
Thank you for the wrap, Noel. Appreciate that. 23 to 1, no rainfall over 5 millimetres in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning anywhere around Western Australia. Hopefully that'll change over the next couple of weeks or so. Still to come, between now and the news at 1, off to Mushay for the results of the sheep market and the latest inductee into the Agricultural Hall of Fame. It's happening right now at a special luncheon being held in Perth. We'll get to that shortly for you. Now, you would have heard Ali in the news headlines just telling you that a couple in the United States has just been awarded more than $2 billion. This was a court case against agrochemical giant Monsanto. The jury concluded that Monsanto's weed killer Roundup was responsible for their cancer. Richard Hudson's been following this latest case. Richard, that's a massive amount of money.
Certainly is, isn't it? It's a record amount against Monsanto, which is a company that's now owned by Bayer. So it's awarded to a couple who live just east of San Francisco in California. They're in their 70s now. Alberta and Alva Piliod are their names. And they developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a form of cancer, and they claim they used Roundup for 30 years to kill weeds on a number of their properties. Now, you might remember back in March we chatted to San Francisco Chronicle reporter Bob Agelko. He's a very experienced legal affairs reporter who's been covering these court proceedings in San Francisco. Let's hear his summary of today's proceedings.
The jury today in California State Court, Alameda County, decided, first of all, that notwithstanding Monsanto's argument that this product is perfectly safe, and in fact, the U.S. regulatory agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, also considers it safe, the jury found, first of all, that Roundup caused the cancer. Second of all, that Monsanto acted with malice, as it's called legally, deliberately or recklessly, marketed this product without warning of dangers that they must have known about. And they awarded the couple $55 million in damages for their losses and $1 billion each in punitive damages for the malicious conduct.
$2 billion is a lot of money. Is it inevitable Monsanto and parent company Bayer will appeal?
Yeah, it is. They've already said they will, and Bob Igelko thinks that figure is going to be drastically reduced because there's a US Supreme Court precedent that says there actually needs to be a limit to punitive damages compared to compensation that's awarded. So he thinks that figure is going to get reduced to about $550 million US. And the two previous court rulings that we've been reporting on the Country Hour, they've also been appealed. That was for $78 and $80 million. They were the amounts awarded in the in these cases against Monsanto.
But $550 million US dollars, still a lot of money.
Still is, isn't it? And Bob Igelko says this will actually be pretty worrying for Monsanto and Bayer bosses.
The fact is, this is the third verdict we have had in the San Francisco Bay Area since last August. All of them in trials by different people against Monsanto, this giant agrochemical company, and all coming to the same conclusion, that Monsanto caused these cancers and that they acted maliciously or recklessly in not disclosing dangers that they must have known about, which they, of course, deny exist.
This is the largest payout, isn't it, that's being suggested after this particular case?
Yes, this one's huge. In fact, the lawyer for the Pilliards, the couple, asked the jury to award $1 billion in punitive damages, saying, you know, this is a company that makes close to that in their annual profit. They were purchased by Bayer, the German pharmaceutical giant, for $63 billion last year. So the lawyer said, send them a message that they'll get, and it's got to be sizable. $1 billion would be fine. The jury saw them and doubled them, awarded each, the husband and wife, $1 billion each in punitive damages. As I said, that's not going to stand even if the verdict itself is sustained, but it's a pretty strong message.
So what sort of message is this sending to agrochemical companies, do you think?
Well, you'd have to think it's a pretty big wake-up call to the new owners of the most widely used herbicide in the world. The main one, I suppose, is don't make out your product is so safe you could drink it. Don't make out products are safer than they actually are, and don't conceal evidence from the regulators. Bob Igelko thinks this warning's been made pretty loud and clear this time.
It's a message not only to this very large chemical company, but to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, that you are allowing the marketing of a product that is causing cancer. And the jury can't force the EPA to say otherwise, but it starts a process in motion, quite possibly, to change the regulation of all of this. And if it doesn't, there's over 13,000 other lawsuits around the United States against Monsanto that await trial in various courts, some here and some elsewhere.
So Monsanto is going to be hoping those future cases don't go to jury. The company is now down 3 from 3. It's a pretty big comeback. Immediately after today's court hearing, Bob Igelko went to the press conference that was attended by both parties.
The woman particularly spoke and said, you know, if we'd ever gotten a warning, we wouldn't have used this stuff. We were reassured that it was the safest possible. Our lives will never be the same. Monsanto, Bayer actually, responded quite strongly, as though they had their statement already prepared. We're disappointed that this product has been shown by numerous studies to be as safe as can be. We're going to appeal, and you know, we sympathize with the family, but we didn't do it. Furthermore, there was some evidence in the case, you know, to the contrary, that both the husband and wife had had cancer before, and different kind of cancer, but that made them, according to medical testimony, quite possibly more vulnerable to the cancer they got, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, than they otherwise would have been. And then Monsanto was arguing, there's no way to know what caused this, but a more likely cause was the vulnerability that these two people had. On the other hand, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma seems to be the most common type of cancer among users of Roundup.
Bob Igelko, legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, that report from Richard Hudson. You can read more on the court case online. There is a link to the article on the ABC Rural Facebook page. In the comments, Nate says, there's an equal amount of evidence that Jesus gave this couple cancer.
and there is overwhelmingly more evidence that he failed to protect them from it. Maybe the church should be helping Bayer come up with the money. This from Jennifer. My father lived till 96. He was a weed sprayer for a lot of those years. We as kids were on a tractor with him, putting out markers covering in Roundup and many other chemicals. No PPE, not even heard of back 40 years ago. Nil cancer in my family. And from Tina, buy Roundup, hello to much stronger chemicals. Be part of that conversation on the ABC Rural Facebook page or the text here, 0448 922 604. A new international report has painted a bleak picture for future wheat prices. On Friday, the USDA released its first world agricultural supply and demand estimates for this season, and it flags a potential record crop coming out of the Black Sea. Rabobank grain and oilseeds analyst Cheryl Kalish-Gordon told Emma Field the market has already reacted to the news.
We're looking at further downside on wheat markets, and we had expected that there might be some revisions that would come in on this one, but the overall picture is that we are looking towards a really ample crop heading into next year after this year being a bit of a pullback on the year before, but heading into higher territory again next year. And of course, that's just pressure on the price globally. And this week we open up the market with CBOT wheat is at the lowest level for 16 months and it's down around 419 cents a bushel.
What's driving that?
So we've got some revision of the expectations out of the US. They are a little lower than expected. That has been offset by higher stocks being estimated for the US. But then you step outside of the US and we're looking at really good production again out of the Black Sea region. And right now, if you put the conservative estimate for production out of Russia at this point is 77 million metric tons, which would be the second highest on record. And alongside that is Ukraine, which is looking at something like 29 million metric tons, which is the highest on record. So there's a fair way to go, but those expectations are really going to weigh the market down. And even if we come close to those, going to keep that wheat market fully supplied into next year.
What are the other issues that are affecting global grain commodity prices at the moment?
We can't escape the impact of what's happening with the US-China trade negotiations. And we have had a fair bit of optimism priced into markets up until the last couple of months, optimism that we were going to have a trade deal come or be made between the US and China. Now, that optimism is fading, and we now see that the soybean price is at the lowest level for 10 years. So you overlay taking out that optimism of a trade deal being made, plus you're putting slower and lower demand on the oil seed front out of China as they look to pursue alternative feed sources, so other than the soy meal that they would get from crushing the beans they import. But also on the horizon and, you know, already playing out is the impact of reduced hog production in China as a result of the African swine fever. So all of that is having a softer demand complex, whilst we've still got a fairly strong supply picture in the world market if you take into account production in canola in Canada, which of course has been put at bay by the Chinese not to take shipments of Canadian canola, but also strong soybean production out of South America and still high stocks in the US. So that oilseed complex is really the biggest driver of what's happening. And as you have those low prices on soybeans, farmers are looking to alternatives. And so those alternatives would be cereals, wheat and corn in particular. And so we're seeing extra supply of those on the market.
Rabobank Senior Grains Analyst Cheryl Kalish-Gordon. And just reading through the WASDE's notes on wheat, it says projected 2019-2020 global trade is sitting at 184.6 million tonnes. That's up 4% on last season. And you heard Cheryl talk about the 77 million tonnes of wheat forecast to be grown in Russia. 36 of that is expected to hit world markets, and that's down slightly, but other major exporters are expected to more than cover that gap. 12 minutes to one. And as I catch up with you this afternoon, there is this special luncheon being held in Perth to celebrate the latest inductee into the Agricultural Hall of Fame. This is an initiative set up by the Royal Agricultural Society of Western Australia to commemorate the achievements of individuals who've made an outstanding contribution to the agricultural industry. And the latest inductee is Darkin farmer Ray Harrington.
you know the name. He's a pioneer agricultural inventor, and you might just have some of his machinery on your farm. In the sheep industries, it's the Harrington crutching cradle, the sheep jetting race, and the V sheep handling machine, all about improving efficiency and reducing physical work in the husbandry of animals. And in the cropping side of things, there's the Agmaster Harrington no-till points, and of course the Seed Destructor, which reduces the reliance on chemical herbicides. Ray Harrington, earlier this year you were named Farming Legend of the Year at the Australian Farmer of the Year Awards, and today another award, this time inducted into the Hall of Fame. What does this one mean to you?
Belinda, I googled the previous recipients of this award last night, and it's become very surreal to join that list of recipients. As I walk down through the page and look at them, I know a percentage of them, played football against one of them, and it's really changed my feelings about the award when I look at the calibre of the people that have been inducted before I have.
And when you look through another list of all the different farm machinery that you've invented over the years, which one are you most proud of when you look through that list?
Probably the Destructor one, in as much as I took it on my own, and it's been a hell of a challenge for 25 years. When you do it on your own, you struggle at night time with what's happening. It's had its challenges, whereas the other ones were quite simple. This one really had to get off the ground before someone would take notice and then come along and join your team.
Now, I think the last time we spoke about the Destructor, I think you'd found someone to manufacture it, and there was that. We were up to that kind of a part of this very long process, as you said, up to about 25 years or so. Can you bring us up to speed with what's going on with the Destructor?
Well, what's going on now, after thankfully being involved with the Stephen Powles and Michael Walsh for the last 15 years, who brought the science to the project, it's been manufactured by De Bruins. We've just brought out about the third or fourth iteration of it now, which has suddenly reduced the cost in half, reduced the horsepower requirements, and at the moment there's 120 going into harvest this year, new machines.
That's around Australia?
That's around Australia, yep.
Yeah, wow. Okay. I'm glad we got a bit of an update on that, because it was going back a few years that we had a chat, yep, specifically about the Destructor. What are you working on at the moment? Is there anything else that you're tinkering away at?
Oh, probably the latest one is the weed chipper that's suddenly been released at Crop Updates last February. That was a bit of a brainwave. I was travelling through western New South Wales, and they've got a huge problem with the native species that they knocked out of the pastures with glyphosate, and suddenly they've become resistant. And the only way you're going to kill them now is with Group S. That's Group S of steel. And working with the Uni of WA again, we've come up with a machine that will go through, detect the weeds because they're green, and take them out with a share on the hydraulic tine. And that's been released.
On ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you. In the studio this afternoon is Ray Harrington, a Darkin farmer, and you would have heard the name before, but he's just in the studio today because he's the latest inductee into the Royal Agricultural Society of WA Agricultural Hall of Fame. While you're here, Ray, can we just head off to Darkin, to the place where you farm, about, well, just over 200 kilometres southeast of Perth. How is the season shaping up for you? I imagine it's pretty much a similar story right around the grain belt. That wait for rain continues.
The wait certainly continues. I don't believe it's desperate at the moment. It rained on the 24th of May last year. We're a little bit worse off, I'll say, than last year. We had 80 mil in January last year, and had a bit of subsoil moisture, which with our no-till and whatever, we were able to utilise that last year and get our crop sown dry, and it actually came up on that 80 mil. We're well into sowing now dry. We act like wheat belt farmers in Darkin. But hopefully it'll rain by the 24th of May again this year. It's not looking that promising, but we're just going to box on anyway. But water's starting to become a little bit of an issue. But Belinda, in 56 years, you've seen it all before.
Do you have contingency seeding plans? Do you have a plan A, B, C, D?
Absolutely, yeah.
Where are you up to?
We've just made our seeder so we can sow shallow, sow deep. We've changed the whole system over to adjust to where we sow the crop as to where the moisture is. If there's no moisture down deep, we'll sow it on top and a shower of rain will get it up. So don't change varieties much in Darkin. Like canola doesn't go out because we probably as safe as you're going to get in the state. I understand why other people have to take it out. But at the moment, our real contingencies are about trying to make changes to get the crop to strike. Because if it strikes in Darkin, it won't die. That's simple as that.
So how do you, at this point in the season, and that wait for rain continues, how do you approach it sort of mentally at this point? Because it's getting closer and closer to that kind of window of opportunity closing.
Belinda, a third of the crop's in. The canola's in, the lupins are in, the Canadian red winter wheat's in.
So you don't lie awake in bed at night worried at all about it?
No, not like we used to, Belinda, because with our weed control strategy, and it's not about the destructor, I like to put my hand out and say, for weed control is the key. You can sow dry if you've got your weed under control. So we've used the ARI, narrow row spacing, high sowing rates, east-west sowing, and then harvest weed seed management. Because we can now afford to go in dry, knowing we've got the weeds under control, and take that risk. We are still struggling with the dry gravel hills, but they'll just get sown shallow now, and a shower of rain will get them up.
Ray, great to have you in the studio, and congratulations again.
Good. Thanks, Belinda.
Ray Harrington, Darkin farmer and the latest inductee into the Royal Agricultural Society of Western Australia's Agricultural Hall of Fame. Maybe best known for the seed destructor invention, which is now in the hands of the Grains Research and Development Corporation, which put a lot of money into the project. And as Ray was telling me, GRDC now owns the intellectual property rights. So basically owned by farmers, I guess. 4 minutes to one on the Country Hour. News at one. We've got the markets to get to before that. And it's off to Mouchet this afternoon for the results of the sheep market. 17,500 sheep and lambs sold. That's down almost 5,000 on last week. John Testrow, it's still quite a big yarding. Is that a reflection of the dry season?
Yeah, good afternoon, Bill. You're right there. But the yarding today comprised mainly lambs with a falling quality of mutton, and live exporters were very active. They pushed medium weight merino weather lambs up by $10. The balance of the lamb market was relatively firm, and that's apart from the heavy lambs that gained $5 and topped at $195. In the mutton market, light boners gained $10 on a light selection, and heavy ewes and weathers were up by $5, also number driven. Rams today gained $20 on the back of strong live export inquiry. But for some quotations, I'll run through the market for you. As I saw at the store, crossbred lambs to feeders, they sold from $26 to $83, remained firm. Air freight lambs remained strong. The Ramadan festivals to go through to the 4th of June, and we expect this market to hold up. They sold from $90 to $137 at 720 cents a kilo carcass weight. Trade lambs 18 to 20, $135 to $152 at around 710 cents. The 20 to 22 kilos, $142 to $168 at $705. The 24 to 26, they sold from $160 to $180. They gained $5 at 670 cents a kilo. 26 kilo up, made up to $195, and that topped the market. Ram lambs today, they sold from $147 to $182, relatively firm. Hoggets to the trade, $100 to $150. They fell $5. That was quality driven. In the store market, store merino ewe lambs, $40 to $113 to graziers, very firm. Store light merino weather lambs, they sell from $30 to $106 to feeders, but the market took off on the medium weights. Live exporters were right on these. They sold from $90 to $142 and they gained $10. In the ewe market, as I said, light numbers. Light boners, $60 to $74. They gained $10 at around 4.60 cents a kilo. Medium weights, $120 to $130, firm at $495, and the heavy weights, the same money. They sold from $122 to $150 and gained $5. Best heavy weathers to processors today, they sold from $130 to $180 with live export very active at $102 to $145, and the live export purchases were up by $10. Rams today, they sell from $90 to $110, again pushed by live export, they gained $20. That's been Mews Show for today. Bell, this has been John Testrow for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the ABC.
Thank you very much for that, John. Just on the news that Ray Harrington is being inducted into the Agricultural Hall of Fame today, Stewie the Dogger says Ray is a legend, good, smart Aussie, ocker know-how, never give up attitude. The other big news today, a couple in the US has just been awarded more than $2 billion. This was a court case against agrochemical giant Monsanto, the jury concluding that Monsanto's weed killer Roundup was responsible for their cancer. Brad says, have to ask the question how these people were handling Roundup to get cancer. If they were dousing themselves from head to toe, then what do they expect? I didn't follow the instructions. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.